From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
It's The Media Project, a half-hour commentary, analysis, and maybe even a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. I like that phrasing, so I've started using that all the time these days. It came to me one day that if we're lucky, we'll have some insight. Anyway, I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Ho.
He of a little red cap with a ball on top in honor of the season. And full house today, here is Stu Shinsky, a longtime executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. Sir?
Hello. An honor to be here.
Great to have you here. And Kaylin Brown, head of communications, professor of journalism, or I said that backwards, the head of journalism, professor of communications at the College of St. Rose. Whatever.
Right. La, 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 la.
La, 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 la. Right. It's great to see you all here and to be part of the media in the holiday season of the year. You know, it's a time when you kind of think about what your wishes are for a year upcoming, what you might think about would be a good thing for the media. And I'm reading the words of Tracy Powell, a fellow of the Democracy Fund, writing on a Stanford University website, who says, "I wish I could convince newsrooms that our mission is about informing everyday people rather than getting caught in the middle of who's up and who's down in Washington, D.C., that it's about public service, not gamesmanship." What do you think about that? Are we too involved in who's up and who's down in Washington?
I don't think so. This being Alan, I think, in fact, it is the job of the media to give people not only what they need, but what they want. And I think that, you know, at the very top of this pile is a guy named Donald Trump, who is doing immense harm to this country and who may, in fact, lead this country into a sort of fascistic state. I think he's trying very hard to do exactly that, and therefore he becomes really important. I live with a woman who, frankly, I'm actually married to her for 47 years, but I live with a woman who really wakes up very concerned about Trump. Can't get away from the media, thinks that he's doing immense harm to the country, and therefore I think we cannot let it go. I think people let Hitler go way too early.
But the media isn't letting coverage of important stories go, and it starts at the local level. Local journalism is the best place for citizens to be informed about what's happening. And if that continues to happen, if local journalism continues to cover its communities, I think that citizens will be informed and they will recognize how their democracy is working or not working. I don't think that all the media is about what's up and what's down. I do think a lot of the coverage in Washington is about that, but there's a lot more to journalism than just Washington, D.C.
Well, of course, and I'm sure you say that to your students in your classes, which I really respect. However, I do want you and Rex, Stu and Rex, to answer this question for you. Why are we taking so many resources away from local coverage at this time when you say, in a sort of very well-intentioned but very goody-two-shoes way, that we already do this?
Here's Stu.
Well, I would add that this Tracy Powell, who wrote this, and the headline on it is "One Journalist's Five Holiday Wishes for the Media." I think she totally blew it. I think she's off on an island somewhere and is clueless. The main point here is that not on her wish list is an economic silver bullet that's going to save the media, because she has all these great wishes, but she doesn't give one iota of a clue of how to pay for it. Community journalism, definitely. It's the lifeblood of so many, 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 many newspapers, and most newspapers and media organizations are community-driven. You hear about the Times, you hear about the Washington Post. But the real problem is in these communities, and a lot of these communities' papers do not have the resources anymore to do the great job they need to do. So if there's one holiday wish for the media I have, it's a mega windfall of immense proportions into every newsroom to fund journalism. Does that silver bullet exist economically? I don't think so, unfortunately.
And if I had a single wish for the media, I would take the words of Barbara Streisand, who said, look at yourself.
Well, Alan, look at yourself. What do you mean? What's that mean? I don't understand.
I mean, look at yourself. See whatever sins you may have. Is it the sin of arrogance? Is it the sin of we're better because, you know, we're reporting on this? To me...
You have a confession you'd like to make as powerful... You know, you run a powerful media organization that reaches 7 states, that has a certain responsibility. So look at yourself. How are you doing?
Well, I don't think we're doing well enough, to be honest with you, Rex. I think that we can always do better. And the difference between me, perhaps, and maybe you, is that I know we can always do better.
There's your holiday wish, folks. Thanks for tuning in.
But I think one of the flaws of journalism is, to a fault, it's very introspective. I almost think journalism is too introspective. It spends so much time reviewing what it does wrong. It should spend more time. Some of that energy could be better spent on producing more solid coverage. I think it's doing what it can with resources it has, but I think that journalism can continue to produce more and better work. And I agree with Stu that we do need an economic silver bullet. I think that there have been proposals. I remember several months ago on this program talking about New Jersey was talking about some sort of legislative initiative to try to fund nonprofit journalism. So I think that we could think about all that. I also believe that we need to wish that citizens want to be informed by the best news organizations, and that citizens have an obligation, too, to get themselves informed.
You know, when you say that, it brings up something that I wanted to say this week that I hope you'll forgive me for. But a great man named Bob Wilmers died this week, and he was the head of the M&T Bank. And he and a group of other very wealthy people had decided to put some real money into the Berkshire Eagle. We've mentioned that on the show many times, to resurrect it. And he said, I want it to be the best local newspaper in America. And he deserves a lot of credit for having done that. And I only say that now because you have just brought up this very important point about what can be done. We know that public radio is funded almost exclusively by its members. And maybe we have to start taking a look at a different way to do the news media. Not all. We have the wonderful Hearst organization, which Rex works for, and it runs some excellent newspapers. But there may be other models we should be looking at.
It's working in Philadelphia. You know, the Philadelphia newspapers, it's a nonprofit cooperative. I think it's called Philadelphia Media Network.
I think that's something like that.
Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News. Now, are they flush with money? Are they hiring hundreds of reporters? I don't think so. But I think a lot of the pressures that they've had, some Wall Street pressures, decision-making that was not made in their newsrooms, they're local. They're a very in-house organization that is not dependent on, you know, a stock price or a public share offering or whatever. They take their money, they reinvest it in their product.
Well, let me just say that every innovation has within it its own devils. And what I mean by that is it may well be that a group of very wealthy people or a very wealthy person takes over the Washington Post. And I'm a big admirer of Jeff Bezos, and I think he's done a wonderful job with the Washington Post. But you never know whether some guy takes over even a group, and one oligarch takes over the management of that group and becomes a terrible person, so that within every kind of organization, you can find the potential for its death knell.
Certainly true. So you have to hope then, I guess what you're saying is you hope that those people who take over media organizations are committed to great journalism so that they will take a lower margin. Or
as opposed to, Rex, to somebody taking over a news organization and getting even with his enemies, his political rivals or his enemies. It's happened before. It happens in politics all the time. It could happen in the news media.
It tends to not, you know, I think people fail to understand that there are structures in place and standards in place in significant media organizations that stop that from happening. And you've seen some of that even at the Las Vegas Review-Journal, which was taken over by Edelson, who was the great funder of Newt Gingrich and of all kinds of right-wing
causes. Trump.
And when Edelson took over the Las Vegas Review-Journal, many of the staff left. But even so, the people he's installed have, at a certain level, resisted his efforts. I think it's fair to say that.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. He brought in some really well-known journalistic, Keith Moyer, mm-hmm. former editor of the Democrat Chronicle here in New York State, mm-hmm. In Rochester. I believe he was also an editor in Minneapolis, perhaps.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are people with serious journalistic chops who, frankly, are known for standing up for the craft. Mm-hmm. And that's important. But yeah, sometimes you get the despot who sucks every dime out. And sometimes you find the benevolent, maybe Bezos is benevolent mm-hmm. in many ways. The Post is doing quite well.
Well, and speaking of Post, let's take a look at the other Post. The New York, P-O-S-T, a name which I don't like to say because I've always been so aghast at the way they do things. Now, the Murdoch boys have stepped in, and I don't know about you guys, but I see a real difference in the way that that paper is doing things. In fact, I think they're, you know, they still have girly pictures and things like that virtually every day. But I think there's a fairness, more of a fairness than I remember from the old days.
They've got a lot more Trump-ishing.
I have not. Well, there's some of that, I think, but that's only because it's so populist. So when he does have, I've not noticed it to be a more responsible organization. Maybe I need to read it more closely. I have not noticed the New York Post.
Well, I read it with a magnifying glass every day, so I know.
Better organization at all. I wouldn't be so kind to them, Alan. I think I like your previous stance better.
And as the token woman here, I'll comment on the girly pictures. So if there are girly pictures in there
every day.
Then the Post will not be on my top 10 list.
No, I get it. But I'm talking about the general tenor of the newspaper. I think Rex makes a very good point, as always, which is that it may be that I'm confusing some of their anti-Trump articles with a more fair approach. But I don't think you would have seen that in the old days.
I don't know. I think, you know, the thing is that the great news is that there are, in all the major, let's be clear that we're talking, here we are talking about major media organizations like newspapers and television network news and so on. There are standards and practices in place that I think readers don't even understand. In fact, there's a sense that one of the best things we could do to build, and we talk about this on this program often, and one of the best things we could do to build more understanding and to get more attention to real journalism is to educate people, to people who have researched media literacy. News literacy say that it's easier to teach people how the media works than it is to change their political viewpoints. And if you could teach people what is going on about how reporting is done, if we could be more transparent about what it means when you use phrases like sources close to and that kind of thing, maybe that would make a big difference in sustaining journalism if people understand what it is and why it has value.
You know, it probably might, but I wonder if people are open to that these days, because I think in many ways those people who are curious about those things, they probably already read papers. But to get the disenfranchised who feel that newspapers don't serve them or have agendas or have other ulterior motives, I don't know if they're going to basically come back with a few explanations. I think they've had it in many ways. You know, and there's always the people who, hey, you screwed up my grandfather's obit in 1823, so I'm never reading you again.
Exactly.
Right.
You know what? You missed something. You had a comma somewhere instead of a semicolon. And, you know, they're just, you know, well, I can't trust you.
Well, you know, we get it on the radio all the time. We use a phrase or we use something and somebody's going to criticize you for it and say they want an apology or they want a retraction. And when you're wrong, you should retract. And we do. But when it's just a matter of nuance, that's another whole story.
But your point, Rex, I'm sorry, is that it should be done anyway. Even if some people won't, because it will help those who are interested in newspapers, it will help them with a deeper understanding. I'm sorry, Carolyn.
That's fine. And there are a number of organizations trying to educate their readership, their viewership, their listenership on how they do business. The New York Times has the Times Insider that you can find out how a story was built out. The Poynter Institute is doing all sorts of work on trying to educate the public in news literacy and media literacy. And universities across the country are working on media literacy, too. It needs to begin early, though. I would say in the elementary school, we should be teaching children how news gathering works, what it means to interview a source face-to-face instead of over the phone or via email, and what are the implications of those choices. It's a complicated process, and it's on purpose. That's how the facts are checked. So if we share, if the media shares how that happens, I think the public would have a very different understanding, because I think the public often believes it's all opinion-based, that a journalist just says what they think, and it's not that simple at all.
You speak of the Poynter Institute. A new study that's found that Poynter did found that 69% of news consumers believe that the media is biased and that news organizations tend to...
What percent is
that? 69%.
69?
Mm-hmm. Right. Say that news organizations favor one side on political and social issues, and almost half of them believe that the news media fabricate stories about President Trump, quote, more than once in a while.
Well, can 50 million Frenchmen be wrong? In other words, if 69% of the people believe that, perhaps there's a little fire with the smoke.
There's absolutely truth to the fact there's bias. I think everyone sitting around this table has a bias. Sorry, Stu, I've just met you today.
I hate the Yankees.
Go us.
Go, see?
So what does that mean? It means we each come from different backgrounds. You know, we don't get birthed into a bubble. There are different effects on us. We are the oldest child in our family. We are the youngest. We are the only. We are raised in a faith or not in a faith.
Yeah,
we're
raised
in the city or in the country. All of those biases affect how journalism does its job.
Yeah,
because journalists are people too.
But there are in place standards, as you were just saying, that are intended to interfere with those biases, right? That is why you have multiple editors reading stories. That's why we have standards that people don't understand. For example, we've had recent stories in the aftermath of the Harvey Weinstein effect. We've had local stories where the result of our investigative reporting, we have the mayor of Cahoes, for example.
Wex. Now, you better watch it this week, because I backed off last week, but I have a few things to say about that.
Many,
go ahead.
A many-year history of domestic violence. We have the Rensselaer County Executive Elect, a member of the state assembly, who seemingly had physically assaulted a staff member and then engaged in just horrendous conversation with this person, very vulgar stuff on tape. And all of this stuff we checked and double checked and triple checked many times.
But still, you have to make a decision, and you made that clear last week. I'd like to revisit that for a moment, which is, if you think that the mayor of Cahoes, in pointing a finger at the mayor of Albany unfairly, you say, and without substance, that should not be covered by your newspaper, you're making an editorial decision, aren't you?
That's my job.
Yeah. I hear it. And that's why the 69%. Because the 69% think that newspapers have an agenda that favors some.
Well,
it favors everyone. That's the difference. The favoritism is toward everyone.
What are you, his lawyer?
That'd be a good job.
That would be a good job. You get paid a lot. We use that lawyer a lot.
Sure, I'll be Eve Burton.
Yeah.
But that's the test. I mean, can you defend to a logical... I mean, I used to face very similar decisions when I was editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal and editor of other newsrooms, where you have these controversial stories. And sometimes it's that he said, she said, and you have to go deeper than that. And you have to look at your values as a journalist. You have to look at your community standards. You have to look at ethical parameters. You have to make sure to the nth degree that if you're going to go with something, you better have it correct and in context. And I think a lot of people, when they disagree with something, either they don't understand the context, or honestly, they just don't want to read it. So therefore, they disagree with it.
Yes.
And they point at you saying, well, you can't put that in the paper.
Here's an example, actually. We had a couple of years ago, we had a bunch of women arrested in massage parlors here for allegedly sex acts,
yes,
right.
Yes.
And a local public official, in the context of the arrest, said, you know, this is human trafficking, seemingly. There's a lot of human trafficking that goes on in these situations. Well, we ended up not using that quote because we thought that that was potentially libelous, as a matter of fact, to the owners of those massage parlors, even though the public official said it. There was no evidence to support that. There was no charge of human trafficking.
And that is a legal charge, human trafficking. That
yes.
is different than promoting prostitution or whatever. It's a whole different legal arena.
So we actually stepped back, not just for fear of libel, but because we thought it was unfair to quote the public official. And this is one of those ethical issues in journalism. Some people would say the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, the first point of it is seek the truth and report it fully. It is not to say, quote, just report what somebody says. That is not ethical journalism. Finding the truth is what's important. And so in seeking to report the truth, sometimes that requires you to not report everything that you're told.
I hear you, Rex. But isn't truth a elusive concept.
Yes,
in
sir.
In other words, because
absolutely.
One person's yes. truth may not be another's.
Absolutely true.
There's no one truth for anything.
And that's why it gets very difficult.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Which is why fact-checking matters, which is why fact-checking has become such a secondary business now. It's always existed in newsrooms, but now because of platforms like Facebook, they are employing fact-checkers, and there are fact-checking operations around the country because of the allegations that everything in the mainstream media is not factually accurate. I won't use that term that I would like to see go away. There's actually an argument about president's allegation about should we use the term which disparages news organizations, and I would say no, we should not use that term. So
that term spelled F-A-K-E?
The F word. That's my F word.
But it is so interesting that with this group of what I would call, and you guys will...
With all due respect, he's going to say.
You guys may get angry with me for this, but the crazies, the guys on the right wing, the far right, the Breitbarts and the Fox Newses and all the rest of this stuff, they have millions of people who are listening to every word they say. And believing every word they say. And that, by the way, is probably how Donald Trump got to be president of the United States, because they believe that. And you can't dismiss it as being irrelevant, because it's very real. And to the people who are listening to that garbage, and that's the word I'm using, it is fact. It's fact.
If you want to share your thoughts, by the way, this is The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio, media@wamc.org. We welcome that. That's Dr. Alan Shartok, Stu Shinsky here, and Kalen Brown with Rex Smith. Stu, how many years did you spend as a newspaper editor, by the way?
I joined management in 1989 when I was the deputy city editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal, and left the Poughkeepsie Journal as executive editor in 2016, having been a managing editor of a major metro in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, a small daily in Norwich, Connecticut. Worked at USA Today as an editor as well.
So how many, let's see, I'm trying to do the math. How many years was that? In
89 to 27 years.
27
and
years.
And yet.
In management.
And yet he turns out to be a decent, wonderful man.
Wait a minute, you met my wife? How can you say that?
Notwithstanding.
But I appreciate that question, and I'd like to comment on that. The difference now of managing a newsroom, and you've certainly seen this, and Kalen in your time, and Alan certainly, the managerial responsibilities of a newsroom now are so much different than what they were even 10 years ago or 5 years
ago. How so, Stu?
Well, for instance, yes, you're managing different types of responsibilities, but, now it's a lot harder to manage with less than with more.
Oh, sure.
A lot harder to manage.
Oh, sure.
When you talk about what the responsibilities of a newsroom, a lot of these newsrooms don't have that ability to do the fact-checking to the extent that a newsroom such as Rex.
Oh.
Even though it's a smaller newsroom than it used to be. I mean, if you look at a newsroom with five people, okay, they're not doing those high-level stories on a consistent basis with the level of clarity and professionalism that maybe they did when they had another 10 people
and
in
one
the
other,
newsroom.
And
that
other...
is one of the reasons fake news, has propagated, because the depth of reporting on a consistent basis has fallen across the industry, because there's fewer people to do it, and a lot of the vets have left the industry, and a lot of the rookies who are coming in who are making $30,000 a year, they don't have the savvy or life experience.
And a lot of the good ones who you've turned into ace reporters... Rex has got a major newspaper here, I can tell you that. But every once in a while, he loses somebody to somebody who's a little higher on the pecking order, who come in and grab something.
They go out like Kalen and get a PhD and become a professor.
Right. Which is a much better job.
But I'm hoping that I'm helping students become educated and excited about journalism, and that Rex will hire them and that Stu would have hired them. And are people who are excited to do journalism.
And then I read this week that the Washington Post is eating the lunch of the Wall Street Journal.
And hiring their people left.
Left
and right.
Best people.
Yeah.
The Journal has lost some steam because there are shreds of evidence that the opinions of Rupert Murdoch are making their way into the newsroom, which has not been the case in most of the years he's owned the paper.
Interesting. Right. That is interesting.
Yeah.
I see we're almost wrapping up, and I'd just like to make a little toast to the year of the woman in the news. And were I the editors
here.
Of Time, I would say it has been the year of the woman. And what we can do this coming week is go see the Post. I have Catherine Graham's book here.
I see that.
And she's one of my heroes in journalism. So that movie, The Post, is coming out on Christmas Day.
It's a great thing. So be sure that you do that. Played by Meryl Streep.
Who went to Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Well, how about that? A final plug from the man from Poughkeepsie, Stu Shinsky, Caitlin Brown, Alan Chartok, and Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.